Today we're going to be talking about addictions. And here's one of my addictions right here, one of my dogs. She doesn't bother me until much like a kid, until you get on the phone or start doing something. But today we're going to be talking about hypnoaddictionology, habits and addictions. And it's one of my favorite topics, as a lot of people know. Of course, I wrote a book on it called The Alcohol and Addiction Solution. So it's one of my favorite, and I'm updating the book too, by the way, as I redo this course, which you'll hear about it. I'm going to redo the book, update it based on new information. So anyway, addictions. First of all, just some quick background. At least 160 people a day die. That's just in the United States. And that's a conservative estimate, according to one of the groups of family practitioners, American Medical, whatever they are, the family docs. They think it's probably 3 to 5 times higher than that, because a lot of people that die from an addiction, their doctor may, you know, put it down to liver failure, you know, congestive heart issues, whatever, but they won't list it as an addiction, even though the addiction may be the primary cause. And they might do that for family reasons, you know, insurance, could be all kinds of things. It's the number one cause of divorce, right? People have a few drinks, they do stupid shit, say stupid shit, and they get in trouble. Substance abuse, of course, is the number one thing of the prison population, especially here in America. When they closed the mental health centers in the 1980s, the prison and the county jails became the de facto mental health treatment center. I can talk to this by fact, as being the clinical director of a psych unit of a prison, doing a lot of psych work at jails or back in when I was up north. It's horrible. It costs, it says $650 billion. They think it's over $1 trillion in lost business income, you know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. The list goes on and on. Majority of auto deaths, things like this, you know, but we got to remember, I always throw this one in there, that 70% of the alcohol consumed is consumed by 10% of the drinking population. So at any given time, a lot of people don't drink for whatever reason. So the few, that's like 20 to 30%. So you take that off of the people that drink, 70% of the alcohol is only consumed by 10% of the people that drink. Now, and this seems to hold true for the other drugs, cannabis, you know, smoking dope, pain pills, all this cool stuff, right? And again, alcohol withdrawal kills more people than all the other drugs combined. And in our culture, there's a social stigma about not drinking if you're in a general population, and also maybe not like smoking dope if you're in certain other populations. I always like to say, so within, as within, so without. So to make these changes, you have to change your internal representations, your internal state, if you want to change your external behavior. If you only change your external behavior and you don't change the insides, eventually you'll go back to the external behavior again. Again, everybody watch on Facebook, click like and share. If you're watching this on YouTube, click like and share. So today we're going to do a background, some fun stuff, and of course I'll do a little thing. I always say, you know, alcohol, drugs make you do stupid things, right? You know, and those on Facebook, you can't see the slide. It has a picture of a whiskey bottle, and the whiskey bottle's whispering to somebody, you should fight that cop. When you're under the influence of alcohol, even a tiny bit, you do dumb things. There's a reason we call it social lubricant. It removes inhibitions. You know, how many of us that, you may not be an alcoholic, I admit I am, but those that aren't, that you're out at a party, you're at a conference, you're having a few drinks, and somebody goes, we should get back, we got to get up early. And you go, I'll be fine. And then at, you know, 7 o'clock when your alarm goes off, you go, what was I thinking? Well, you weren't. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So what do people try if they're going to try to not, you know, what do people do if, you know, if they want to quit? So here's what people generally try. They try to white knuckle it. You know, I'm just going to white knuckle it. I'm going to buckle down. They try willpower, which usually it doesn't work, I'll be honest with you. They go to a 12-step program. That's AANA, one of the A programs, one of the anonymous programs. Maybe they go to therapy. And in our culture, a lot of people end up switching drugs. And, you know, whether that's they go from like alcohol and illegal drugs to legal drugs, they get on, you know, barbiturates, phenobarbital, things like that, anti-anxiety meds. So those don't work. They just, they're kind of, as I always say, they're kind of changing seats on the Titanic is basically what happens. So let's have some fun with this. So why is addiction such a big problem? Well, let me repin my video. Okay, cool. All right, cool. So why is it such a big problem? Well, first of all, it's a brain-based disease. It has nothing to do with willpower. It's brain-based disease based in, with the current research, some research on trauma, how your body stores memory, a bunch of other things. It is also partially a learning behavior. You know, it's an adaptive learning behavior and skill, if you will, that, you know, for a long time, drinking might work. Again, hey, everybody on Facebook Live, click like and share. If you're watching on YouTube, click like and share. There's a lot of social pressure about drinking, drugging. Depends what group you're warming with. There could be family pressure, right? And then, of course, there's the whole denial. I don't have a problem. I'm not that bad. Especially, we always forget 90%, especially like alcoholics, are highly functional. And even a lot of the drug addicts are highly functional. And so that's their last scope of denial is, I still have a job, I still have a house, I got three cars, whatever it is. And for years, though, people spent an enormous amount of time trying to figure out why they were an alcoholic, thinking if there's just one why, if you fix the why, then everything will change. It doesn't. You get insight. This is based in insight therapy. Hey, Monica. Hey, let me say hi to some people. Leonard. Bridget. So you get insight, and then all you are is an insightful alcoholic or drug addict. It doesn't necessarily change the behavior. This little slide kind of says it all. Maybe I drink because you pretend to throw the ball. It shows a drunk dog, right? That's true. You could chase whatever it happens to be. There may be no why. There may be, as some hypnotists would call it, an initial sensitizing event. There could be a lot of factors. And if you focus on the why, you lose the how. But some of it could be linked to guilt, shame, and a feeling of worthiness. You know, guilt is, I made a mistake, right? I got drunk, I did something stupid. I made a mistake, right? Shame is, I'm a worthless human being, right? There's a difference. You know, if you have guilt, you know, has some, I don't want to say redeeming qualities, but guilt has some, it might stop you from doing it again. But shame is when you internalize it to the point where I'm the problem. It's not the fact that I was drunk. It's not the fact this happened. And then you feel unworthy. And if you feel unworthy, whether you go through therapy, whether you go through a treatment center, whether you go to AA or whatever you do, you may end up sabotaging yourself. At least that's been my experience lately, right? So why do people avoid getting help? This is a big question. Since it's out there and people are always talking about it, for a long time, they were talking about the opioid epidemic. It's kind of went on the back pages. Thousands of people are still having problems with it and dying, but it's, you know, the news cycle is over. And it will be until a rich white celebrity overdoses again, and then it suddenly people will start talking about it, right? So why do people avoid help? There's the stigma of the problem. You know, our culture, we don't want to admit we have problems. There could be work issues. If you have certain, you know, it depends what you do for a living. If you go get help, and in America anyway, for all my foreign people, in America, if it goes on your insurance, this could cause some problems, right? Because even though your doctor, your therapist is bound by confidentiality, your insurance company is not, right? So your insurance company could release to your employer, well, this person's using their healthcare where? At this treatment center. Well, it doesn't take much to figure out, right? So there could be that, you know, certain jobs, if you go get help, you could lose your job. I've seen it happen to teachers as much as they say it doesn't, you know, but especially like pilots, police officers in some jurisdictions, medical doctors. If you're a medical doctor or a nurse practitioner, and let's say you haven't gotten in any trouble, no DUI, no trouble with your prescribing, but you go in for treatment, you may be automatically put into that pool of high risk where they're going to start monitoring you. And guess what? Your your malpractice insurance is going to become almost unaffordable. You can't afford it. I can't talk today. And this happened to, I didn't know it, but a person I know, it's a medical doctor, happened to one of his friends. And there could be family issues. You know, your family will tell you to get help, but don't really get help. Things like that. And there could be, how do you take time in this day and age? How do you take time away from work or family? Especially in the Western world, here in the States and somewhat Canada, where you might not have any sick days. You might not have the disability to take the time off to go to treatment. So how do you take the time? What if you're a single parent? Who's going to take care of the kids? You know, I've dealt with that where someone ends up in treatment, court mandated. Well, the courts come in, they take the kids away, put them in foster care. Now, when the person gets out of treatment and they're doing well, it's a nightmare to get the kids back, right? So, you know, go get help. And I've seen this because I've seen this in divorce proceedings where the one person is encouraged to go get help. They go get help. And then the other side, male and female, I have seen, uses that as leverage against the soon-to-be ex-spouse over visitation, over custody, right? So there's a low success rate. You know, I'll talk about that. There's no treatment opportunities as much as we talk about it, unless you got really good insurance. Good luck trying to get treatment in the United States, right? And even anymore, with them going back to the old ways, they will limit your how much help you can get, right? And treatment has not changed much in 50 years. And trauma is one of the underlying things of addiction. You know, trauma is one of the drivers. And what you see in shame is very specific body posture. And you see the same body posture in people suffering from an addiction. And what's interesting, when you have severe trauma, love is the wrong response, right? We think, oh, we'll just love them better. Same way as we know in a long time in addictions, you can't love someone clean and sober, but, and it's not saying you don't love them, but they need help to change, right? Because if it's just too much, it adds to the trauma, which adds to the shame and guilt, right? And so to really change, you have to open up your heart. There's some very specific ways to do that. One of the reasons I'm excited about talking about this stuff is NLP and hypnosis is the perfect fit to treat addictions if, and this is a big if, ladies and gentlemen, if you know exactly what to do and when to do it. And it's another great reason it's great is it's private. Most of us don't collect insurance. You know, I know, I think Dr. Rocky was on this call. You might collect insurance, but some people don't want their insurance if they have an addiction issue, because I could testify to the fact that if you've ever been treated for addictions and then you go to try to get life insurance, that may come up, right? It's happened to me in a couple of different things. So it's private, it's fast. And if you know the current facts, it's great. And I think at least you have to be open to the 12-step kind of approach and pushing people into a 12-step program, right? So let's talk a little bit about habits. What's the difference between a habit and an addiction, right? Everybody forms habits, right? But what's the difference between a habit and an addiction? You know, you get a cue on how you form an addiction. You get a cue and you do a routine and then you get a reward. And your brain remembers, we'll talk about why it remembers that reward. And when you get that cue, you go back into the routine and you'll get the reward and it becomes self-generating. And then what we find is you get the cue, you go into the routine. If you get the reward intermittently, it's even more powerful than every time, right? So that's how you develop a habit. Now, what's the difference between a habit and an addiction? We'll talk about that in a moment. But what happens when you get a cue, your brain goes into highly thinking mode, you know, because they did the study with rats. What they did, the rat was in a maze, and then the rat would hear a buzzer and the wall would go up, and then, you know, it would run down a maze and go find the chocolate. Well, what would happen the first few rounds when it would go off, you know, there'd be the buzzer, the wall would go up, the rat would scratch and sniff. It's how rats think, but it brain was wired up. We could see all this neurological activity. It was thinking. But after several rounds, something magical happens. The cue would happen, the buzzer, the wall would go up, the rat would go, and then instantly its brain almost went to sleep and it would start the routine of running down and going to the right to get the chocolate. Fascinating, right? This is how you form habits, right? And because it goes into different parts of your brain. But you can form a habit, but how long does a habit stay? Right? I always argue this with people. People say it only takes 7 days to make or break a habit. Bullshit. I've known people that's worked out every day for, not every day, but on a routine for 6 or 12 months. They interrupt the routine. They don't go back to the exercise. It was a habit at one point, but they don't go back to it, right? You almost have to purposely hijack the addiction process if you want to make a change like that and make it deep and permanent, because it's the different parts of the brain that get involved with not just a habit, but an addiction. So you always have to do it till it becomes so subconscious you don't think about it. And a subconscious habit would be a good example. If you like drive an automatic car and then suddenly you have to drive a stick shift, when you first start driving it, it's going to be, your brain's going to default to wanting to just put it in drive and go. When I bought the truck I have now, the to change gears is just a knob this way, right? And I was used to it being down here. It took me forever to switch it, right? It took a long time. Now, I remember I was just somewhere and I had to rent a car, and I got in the car, and even though the gear shift lever was down where, you know, like in the console, like my old cars, I was sitting in the car, kept trying to turn this dial, and all I was doing was adjusting or turning up the radio, right? Because it was automatic, right? So what can addictions teach us, right? Well, first of all, there are four specific regions of the brain that are involved in addiction. The first is the nucleus accumbens, right? It's where dopamine's made, right? And when what happens, you get a dopamine boost with the, whatever the boost of the addictive substance is, or the addictive, you know, if it's a substance, alcohol, drugs, something coming in, sometimes even food, you know, it's whatever that substance is plus the dopamine. So they amplify each other, like alcohol and drugs amplifies the dopamine, right? And if it's a process like gambling or sex, it's just the dopamine response. But dopamine's addictive because it makes you feel good, right? It gives you energy. You like that feeling. So that's the first center, it's activated. The second center is the memory center, the amygdala, and somewhat the hippocampus. And what happens, you begin to condition yourself that felt good, I want more. That felt good, I want more. So you start thinking about, well, the last time I drank, and then your brain starts dripping in a little dopamine, I want more. And then that starts the whole physiological craving process, right? So that's the first two centers. The third center is the orbital frontal cortex. Blah. It's where motivation is. And then you start thinking, I really like that stuff, right? The others are kind of more subconscious. They're deeper in your brain. They're more into the deeper parts of your brain, right? So you start thinking, I really like that stuff. I want more of it. Or there'd be a subconscious cue. It could be music. It could be something else in the external world. And then your prefrontal cortex kicks in and you go, your orbital frontal cortex right there kicks in. And suddenly you go, ooh, that reminds me of, you know, if I had a few drinks, it would be better. If I took this, it would be better. And of course, the fourth center involved in addiction is the prefrontal cortex, the last part of our brains to develop. And this is where it puts the brakes on things. The problem is it's not a very good break. And by the time it starts getting activated, one way to think about it is the train has left the station. And so again, a simplified way to look at a habit, which can become an addiction, is you have a routine that leads to a reward. And if you get a reminder to do the routine, you'll want to go get the reward. And so you get into this circle. And once you get into this circle, you're screwed, right? And then it becomes self-generating, right? And so when you look at these things, when it comes to treating addictions, for a long time, I was super traditional. 12-step based only. It's the only thing I looked at. You know, I thought that was it. And then, but I changed my mind. A true person that studies research should be open to change their mind, right? So I was very traditional. But then I started reading stuff on trauma, you know, how trauma affects addictions and how many people only think of trauma as like post-traumatic stress disorder, active trauma, you were beaten, you were abused. But now we also know that it's not just acts of a commission, like something bad happens. It could be acts of omission, where you didn't get something you needed. You didn't get the love, nurturing, and encouragement that you needed as a child, and that became traumatic. And maybe they weren't overtly, doing something traumatic. It was inadvertently, and you internalized it. Again, it's not just you did something wrong. You are wrong, right? And so you internalized it. And so there's a lot of thought that a great majority of the people with an addiction have unresolved trauma issues. And this comes from mind-body research, because trauma is stored in the body. It is not just stored in the mind. It is why you can intellectualize going through a traumatic exposure, but it will not always relieve the traumatic memory. Okay? And wisdom, to me, is changing your mind and beliefs when you're giving opposing facts. And that's what happened with me in the 12 step. I still like the 12 step program. I still think it works for most people. But it softened me, right? Because now I understand it's a brain-based issue. I read a book several years ago called The Craving Brain by Dr. Rudnick. And it began to show studies that alcohol and drug addicts' brains react differently, you know, when they monitor the brain activity. It's more like an allergy than just a thought process. You know, some people have an allergy to whatever it is. It's a body response. And that's what is beginning to happen, they think, happening with alcohol and drugs and other addictions. And craving is neurologically based. As I said, once it starts and you've started that dopamine drip and you start like getting on hyper, and then the thought processes lock into, you know what makes me feel better? You know what makes me feel better? You know what makes me feel better? And then you're off to the races. So, the other thing that really made me change my thinking was a study called the Happy Rat. And what the Happy Rat studied, back in the late 60s, I think it was, they took some rats and they hooked them. I think it was heroin first, but they duplicated this with other drugs and they got them hooked, right? They put them in a cage, they got them hooked. And then after the rats were male rats, after the rats were hooked, you know, they'd throw a female rat that was in heat into the cage. The rat wouldn't pay any attention, keep getting high. Throw in food, keep getting high, right? Basically, it would keep getting high till it died. So it started the whole war on drugs, and that addiction is bad, and it's somehow it's the drug. Fine. So, and we criminalized addiction. Not just the drugs, we criminalized being an addict, right? As everyone knows, in the United States and a lot of the Western world, except for some of the more enlightened countries, you know, if you're a low-level drug addict that sells, you're going to get a 30 or 40-year sentence, right? As opposed to a banker that's supplying it, he'll get a slap on the wrist and, you know, probation. And it's because and these studies happened in America where it became politicized. So addiction became politicized. And in our culture, late 60s, early 70s, it was hippies, that was marijuana, things like that. They did it with the African-American, the black community, heroin, other drugs. And then finally it moved into colleges also, where it became political, right? And so we did this. And so what we have to do is make some changes at the inside. And so I had that, you know, I had that happy rat study, and I started thinking, how does this work, right? And then I would call it the Vietnam paradox, and it was like the happy rat study redone. And at the height of the Vietnam War, we had like 500,000 troops in combat, average age 19 to 22, and it was an unhappy place to be. It wasn't a There wasn't any of this. Hey, thank you for your service. We love you. It was a horrible place to be, and the troops that went there, a lot of them drafted, and even if you joined because you were going to get drafted anyway, there was shame, right? And so you had all these troops that were there, and so they self-medicated. They seemed to, and I went in at the end, so I can tell you, there seemed to be like three groups. You had the drinkers, guys that stayed drunk all the time. You had the guys that got high and did other drugs. And you had a small group that were real clean cut. But especially there, so you had those groups. And so the country was gearing up for a huge problem when these troops came back, that you had all these young men trained in combat that had seen combat, become desensitized to combat, that were alcoholic because they were drinking so much they fit the clinical definition of alcoholism, or using drugs to the point they fit the clinical definition of drug addiction, which means they kept doing it in spite of negative repercussions. You know, they were getting, you know, court martials or Article 15s in the Army or Captain Mast in the Navy. So they were constantly getting in trouble. They kept using. So we geared up for this huge problem. And then when the troops came back, guess what happened? 90% of them were fine. They went through a readjustment period, but they didn't have to go through detox or treatment or this. They went back. And many of them went back to normal. Even the people who are drinking alcoholically over there, they kind of, whatever they did, they reset. Now they're normal. They can go to a ball game, have a beer. They could do this, but not everybody could, right? And so it made me start thinking, and I call it the boxes. And so it's like this, and it goes with the Vietnam paradox, right? When you're a young person, you don't have any experience with drugs or alcohol. It may be around you, but you're not using. And then you go into the first stage of experimentation, which usually, you know, as a young person, junior high, high school, you start experimenting. Much as every parent says, not my kids, especially in the Western world, most people are going to experiment with drugs or alcohol. And so many people will experiment. Some will say, I don't like this feeling. They just don't like it. They quit. They're not going to use it anymore. Fine. That's a small percentage. But most people that experiment will go to, I like this. It's okay. A couple good beers, maybe smoke a joint, you know, do a line, whatever. And they're fine. They go to social use. They can use or not use. This is where 90% of the people that drink can stay. You know, not saying that they won't get drunk occasionally, go to a wedding or some big party and get drunk. It's just, it doesn't interfere with their life. They're in the social use phase. Then some people move into the abuse phase. They're abusing the alcohol or drugs, right? And they may be doing it to self-medicate, like the soldiers in Vietnam, right? Like someone going through a divorce, so, you know, a family member's dying and you don't know how to cope, so you're over-drinking. All this other stuff. So you're abusing it to self-medicate. Now, out of all those people that abuse, guess what happens? A lot of them will work through whatever it is and they'll go back to being a social user, or they'll just quit. There's no big deal, right? This is what happened with a lot of the soldiers coming back from Vietnam. They got out of the unhappy rat, right, place and got happy, because then they redid the study about the happy rat. And what they did, they took the rats, they got them hooked again, right, and made sure they were hooked. Again, tested it, threw in a female rat, she ignored it, or he ignored it. But then they, rather than that, they took the addicted rat out of the unhappy rat cage, put it in a happy rat cage where there were a lot of things going on, kids and other rats and food and things to keep them busy and all that. All the rats wouldn't use the alcohol or drugs, even if the same, you know, way to dispense the drug or the alcohol was in there, right? It would ignore it, and it went to a happy rat box, right? So the soldiers coming back from Vietnam, there was some thought, you know, forensically now, looking back, the soldiers that came back to a strong social network where they got, especially at this time, you know, maybe they went back to the steel companies or the auto plants, or, you know, they went back to college and they finished college and they just got back into life. They were happy places. The people that had the most problems were the ones that came back from the unhappy rat box of Vietnam, and there was no future. None, right? There was no jobs. It was the inner city maybe, or, you know, if it was rural, that area had been devastated. And so you kept the self-medication up. It kind of coincides with a lot of the opioid epidemic right now, which is you see it the highest in the places where people have lost their future. You know, the auto plants have closed, the steel companies, the coal mines, you know, the farms are closing. So people are self-medicating. Because again, you go through the experimental phase, you go through the social use phase. This is where most people stay. And if you're here, you don't understand people that abuse alcohol or drugs, right? And even those that abuse it may go back to normal. And it doesn't just have to be negative, like the soldiers in Vietnam or going through a divorce or a death. What if, you know, a kid goes to college and he, you know, had a few beers in high school, no big deal, gets to college, joins a fraternity or a sorority and stays drunk for 3 of the 4 years, is in trouble, but keeps partying. Then they graduate college. They go back home. Again, if they go back home to a strong social network, boom, you know, they quit. You know, they're not the frat boy. They're not the sorority girl. But then again, we all know, we see these people 30 years later, they're still couch surfing. They're still like the, you know, the burned out frat guy. They make comedies about that, right? And it's cute in college. It's disgusting in real life in your 30s or 40s. So you have that abuse. So if it doesn't, and normally what begins to happen, you develop the addiction. And this is where the addiction and dependence on it is. It becomes internalized. So if you go through the experimentation phase to the social use phase, maybe you're abusing it good or bad, but if you can't go back to normal, then you go into the addiction phase. For the people in the addiction phase, the only solution is total abstinence, because you have to change it to the subconscious mind, right? If you don't change it to the subconscious mind, that's where the battle is, right? And we have all these things going on that you must work out. It's also why it kind of explains why the 12-step program works. When it works, it's a support network. It's a nurturing support network. They tell people, you know, you're not a bad person. Guilt, shame, and remorse. You're a sick person trying to get better. You're not a bad person trying to get good. You're a sick person trying to get better. It's an instantaneous reframe, right? And there's a support network of people that can understand you. And it also points out that contrary, you know, most of us would, a lot of times everyone thinks their family, they didn't do this to their kids or whatever. So maybe they don't want the people going to AA or NA or something because it will somehow lessen the family experience. But I think for people to really recover, they have to get into some kind of ongoing support network. I mean, hypnosis and NLP can get people going, get people on the way, get people reframed, boom, but they probably need some other social support network. And it doesn't just have to be Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. I've seen people do it with churches, with getting into exercise programs, with starting businesses, with getting into our field where you start helping other people. And again, it's the happy rat study. If you're in an unhappy rat cage, for whatever reason, it doesn't matter what everybody else thinks of your cage. If you think it's an unhappy rat cage, if you just pull them out, this is what happens with treatment, get them clean and sober down in a beautiful treatment center in Florida, throw their ass back in the unhappy rat cage, and then we're surprised when they relapse, right? Because if you stay miserable, relapse is assured, right? And so we have to change all these different levels, you know, and that's one of the things we can do with hypnosis and NLP. Those of us trained in it that understand what we call logical levels, you know, you have to change your environment, where you live. You have to change your behavior. You might have to get new capabilities and skills. You'll begin to develop different beliefs and values, and eventually your identity will change. But you have to change at all these levels, right? And it's a tougher than people think. And I like to say, you know, the way you recover is those, you can't see it on Facebook, but here you can see it. You know, when it's, you know, how do you recover? Well, when it's time to fight, you got to fight like you're the third monkey on the ramp to Noah's Ark. And brother, it's starting to rain. You have to want it more than anything in the world. One of the things when people call me, I just had this, a guy calls me and says he'll do anything to quit drinking. Great, come in, we'll talk, da, 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 da. And I said, well, I'm going to need you to go to a couple of 12-step meetings. I'm not doing that. Dude, yesterday you told me you would do anything. You know, it's kind of like that song, I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that. Well, then, that to me was a compliance measure. I don't think he's going to comply with anything I say, by the way, right? So anyway, you have to want to do it. So what you need to do is learn about the nature of addictions. This was just very cursory. You know, you need to understand the history of treatment and why it's failed. You need a protocol that works if you really want to help people with addictions. And then you really have to understand how to market. And to tell you the power of some of the things going on beautiful Facebook, you can't advertise that you can help people with an addiction problem unless you go through this third party thing, which is also, from what I understand, owned by the people that they're regulating, right? And so it's basically to keep people out of the business of helping addicts and alcoholics, right? They have And the process is, from what I understand, from when I looked into it, super expensive, very time consuming and long term. And it's meant to keep people out, not to really help you. So you have to understand how to market and how to try to get to the people that you want to help. So what you need to have is an understanding of addictions. You'd have to know how to treat addictions. You mark to the needed population. There's a difference, right? And it can increase your income because it's a different income stream. So I developed, or I'm updating, my hypnoaddictionology course, right? Because I keep changing how I think about these things, you know? And it's an underserved population, right? And how many of us that help people with other issues, whatever it is, weight loss or anything, as you start working with people, this can prop up. I saw it here in beautiful Florida, where people came to me for weight loss, and a couple sessions in, it became obvious a lot of it was their drinking. You know, they were drinking a lot. Why were they drinking a lot? Because they could. They didn't have to get up tomorrow morning. So that third glass of wine, that fourth martini, no big deal. I got nothing to do tomorrow, right? That's why you see it here in Florida. My friends in Florida can testify. You'll be walking around a Publix or a grocery store, and you'll see somebody pushing their cart, and it'll have, you know, several cases of beer, a bunch of bottles of wine, da 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 da, right? Interesting, right? Because they can. And you know, what I'm going to do is teach what I call hypnoaddictionology. And without it, well, you have a missed opportunity, there's lost income, no impact, and people suffer. And I just posted the other day that someone I know had a close friend of the family, like a family member, if you will, you know, die from an addiction. Their child died from an addiction. It's preventable, right? So if you take a class like this, you become comfortable with addiction. The number one reason hypnotists, NLPers, even in the psychotherapy world, people don't want to treat addictions. They're not comfortable with it, right? Even if you took the class and just learned, I don't really want to deal with it that much. You know, if you're working with somebody and that comes up, you can send them to someone. I get a lot of people like that referred from other hypnotists and NLPers to work with the addiction. Then they can go back and work on building their business or whatever it happens to be. You get a new audience. You get a positive feeling for helping other people. It's a positive impact on society. And, you know, people, when you help people, it's fun. So coming next month, April of 2020, I'm going to have an all new hypnoaddictionology class. You'll learn the true way to help people with addictions. You know, it'll be based in fact, research-based, have a lot of science, a lot of techniques, not just learning about what addictions are and all this theoretical knowledge. How do you actually help the people to do this? So if you have any questions, shoot me a text, an email, contact me, and let me know your questions. I'm going to keep people informed as the process develops about how long the class is going to be. It's going to be taught via Zoom. You know, like I'm doing here on this camera, not that camera. And it's going to be a lot of fun. And then it'll be recorded where people can have it, where people can view it. And I found a cool way for people to get the videos in case they miss the weekly training. So I'm working on how long it's going to be and everything that I have to do specifically. That'll be released in the next few weeks. So keep in touch. Let me know your questions. And let me turn off the Facebook. Okay, so let me know. I thank everybody for joining me, and let me know how I can help, and have a great day.